From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those special open lines. Here's what's happening. U.S. public health officials have ramped up their warnings to all of us about the Zika virus now, the mosquito-borne ailment that began to hit Latin America hard last year when we talked about it. Everything we look at, they say, with this virus seems to be a bit scarier than we initially thought. That comes from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They go on to say that they now estimate that the mosquito that spreads the virus is present in 30 U.S. states now, up from an earlier estimate of 12 states. The expert on pandemics, Dr. Gary Ridenour. Gary, it seems to be growing. How come?
It is, and we have, from my references, I've got two cases in Las Vegas and three in Reno already. And the problem is Brazil is broke, and there may be no Summer Olympics, and this may send Brazil underwater before they get there. A few years ago, remember that failed genetic mosquito experiment in Brazil?
Yes.
Well, that maybe those mosquitoes are the cause. 1975,
that could be.
1975, the CIA dumped mosquitoes on Avon, Florida, to see if they could do it with genetically modified mosquitoes. Nothing happened. Brazil is going to try it again, and the mosquitoes only have a 3 to 15% survival. I speak fluent Spanish, and you guys ought to send me down there to get you a good report on that. And in the meantime, CDC is crying, oh, we need more money for this, when the mosquitoes are going to be all over in the United States by fall. So they don't need more money. They need to get off their buns and get going.
All we need is another wet, warm summer, Gary, and we've got a problem here.
We have a big problem coming. And mosquito lights don't kill them because the Anopheles mosquito flies around during early morning and early evening. Unless it transfers over to our local mosquito, which could be a problem.
Now, Gary, Zika's been around for a while. It hasn't been prevalent, but it's been around. Why is it now busting loose?
Nature has a way, and this virus must have mutated because it's
something
now
happened.
Hitting the neurological systems, and people 55 and over are getting a disease called Guillain-Barré, where for a month your arms and legs are paralyzed and 20% of you end up in a wheelchair for the rest of your life.
From a mosquito bite.
From the mosquito bite.
Gosh. Well, folks, take care of yourself. And I mean, get yourself some protection this spring and summer and do whatever you can. I mean, this is crazy. A South Carolina woman has been accused of trying to kill her husband by setting him on fire while he was asleep. What is going on with people? Local news outlets say Union County Sheriff's Office reports that a 44-year-old woman is charged with attempted murder and second-degree arson. The victim, that's the husband, told the deputies that his wife poured gasoline on him while he slept before lighting him on fire. He was flown to a Georgia hospital, second-degree burns on his neck and his back. Lawmakers are calling on the White House to declassify more than two dozen pages in the 9/11 Commission report that they say outlines evidence for possible support from the Saudi government for two hijackers who eventually settled in Southern California before they got involved in their dastardly deeds. We've been reporting on this for years now about this possibility. Howard Bloom with us. He's the expert on many things, and I wanted to bring him in on this topic. Howard, we've been talking about the Saudi involvement in 9/11 for years. Now, look at this. Lawmakers are saying, open up the report. What's your take?
Well, Senator Bob Graham has been pushing for this since he co-chaired the 9/11, one of the 9/11 commissions. He wrote a book in 2004, Intelligence Matters, trying to get us to focus. We have 28 missing pages of this report, 28 pages that are a classified secret. Now, you can understand why they were classified secret under the Bush administration, because the Bush administration had Saudi Arabia as a partner in the White House. Prince Bandar from Saudi Arabia was considered an unofficial member of the White House for 25 years and an unofficial member of the Bush family. And the Bush family and its friends did a lot of business with Saudi Arabia. But then we had a president come into office, Barack Obama, who should have been free of those constraints, and unfortunately has not been, because he has been working so hard to pull off a balancing act with Saudi Arabia's most basic enemy in the world, Iran. He has been making the Saudis very unhappy. The Saudis have been very unhappy because they are running a proxy war right now, and they're running two of them. They're running one in Yemen, and they're running one in Syria. They tried to engage us in the proxy war in Syria, which is a proxy war against Iran. That's what the Syrian civil war is. It is not a civil war. It is basically a war between proxies for Iran versus proxies for Saudi Arabia. And when Barack Obama wouldn't play ball and put troops in there and give them all kinds of advanced weapons, the Saudis got very angry and started going to Moscow and making it clear that they would desert us utterly if we kept this up. So Obama has been caught in the same corner that the Bush family was caught in. He doesn't dare release this report. He's going in 1 week. He's going on the 21st to Saudi Arabia for a major meeting of the Gulf Cooperation Council. And he especially doesn't dare antagonize these people just before he has that meeting. But meanwhile, he has his obligation to the American public. He ran on the basis of a platform of transparency. Josh Earnest, the spokesman, repeated that transparency pledge this week, absurdly, given the fact that there's no transparency on these missing 28 pages. And it's an unusual coalition that is now pushing to make this public. Well, first of all, 60 Minutes put its foot in on Sunday night, making a major expose on this. And Nancy Pelosi kissed Kirsten Gillibrand and Rand Paul, people from opposite sides of the aisle, from opposite political philosophies, are all pushing to make these 28 pages public. And frankly, democracy depends on an informed citizenry, and you and I cannot make informed decisions, the basis of democracy, without knowing what's in these missing 28 pages.
All right, Howard, thank you. Great report, by the way. In Michigan, Amber Waddell's mother went to the dentist for a procedure, never came back. Now Waddell and her family want answers to how April Walters, 46 years old, died after she was only supposed to get her teeth pulled. She went to a Southfield dental clinic to have 18 of her teeth pulled due to an infection. 18 teeth. Though she had health issues, all kinds of problems, diabetes, high blood pressure. She even required the use of an oxygen tank. She had been cleared to have her teeth pulled. When she arrived at the dentist, the medical assistant was a little concerned with her vital signs, but they went ahead with the procedure. The dentist stopped during the procedure after pulling 16 of her teeth, advising the woman to have her heart checked because her heart rate was too high. But something happened, and she died. Wow, sad story. Dry shampoo, be careful here. A hair styling product that cleans hair without water is a convenient product for some people on the go, but for one Irish woman, she has gone bald, she claims, because of it, and is suing the company. She's posted on Facebook, that's been shared now 30,000 times, that she's been diagnosed with hair loss on an area of her head, and she blames this dry shampoo. Famed physicist Stephen Hawking, as we reported several months ago, wants to believe that we aren't alone in the universe, and he's teamed up with a billionaire Russian entrepreneur, Yuri Milner, to push a new $100 million initiative at locating alien life on other planets. Even Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg is getting involved with this as well. But let's check in with SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, Seth Shostak on this one. Seth, I hope you get some of that $100 million. You need to get it.
Well, George, I couldn't agree with you more. But actually, no, we're not getting into that money. Actually, in the last summer, Yuri Milner pledged $100 million for SETI, not at our organization, actually, at the University of California at Berkeley. But this latest initiative today, the press conference that was held this morning with Stephen Hawking and Freeman Dyson and a panoply of eminences, is another $100 million project to go to the stars, to do a study to send a rocket with a small payload to Alpha Centauri, our nearest star other than the sun.
Well, I got to tell you, this is an interesting take. What's so fascinating to me about this, Seth, is the fact that some guy would commit that kind of money to doing this.
Well, that's true, but, you know, Yuri Milner is a very interesting guy, actually. He studied physics. He's a smart character. He likes science, and he's putting money that he made through investment in high-tech companies into science and into research that nobody else might be funding. I mean, you know, the government isn't planning to build a rocket to go to Alpha Centauri. What they're going to send is a payload that's about the size of a silver dollar, but they may send 1,000 of them, and these things will have enough smarts to make some photos and beam back some information. They'll get to this star system, if all goes well, in 20 years. I got to tell you, the fastest rocket NASA owns would take 100,000 years to get to that star. So this is an improvement.
Thank you, Seth. We'll talk to you more. We should get you on for a couple hours. In a moment, convicting the innocent. Death row in America's broken system of justice. It's an amazing story. Stanley Cohen joins me next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. For the next couple hours, we're going to be talking about convicting the innocent. Every day, innocent people across America are tossed into prison, betrayed, they say, by a faulty justice system, robbed of their lives as well. How would you like to be in prison and you know that you are innocent? Some of them have been on death row. Some of them have been killed, and they are innocent indeed. We're going to be talking now with Stanley Cohen. Stanley's a veteran award-winning newspaper and magazine journalist for more than 50 years. He's worked as an editor, writer, reporter for newspapers, magazines, news services. He has taught writing, journalism, and philosophy at Hunter College and has written this book, Convicting the Innocent. Stanley, welcome to the program. It's good to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
What a story. For years now, of course, we've heard these horrendous stories of people who've been incarcerated only to get released 10, 20, 30 years later when evidence pops up, especially DNA evidence, that these people never did it. When they're in jail, and you know they keep telling everybody, you know, I didn't do it, which, of course, in Shawshank Redemption, everybody said that. What do these people do? I mean, they must, are their lives are ruined, Stanley.
Well, they certainly are. It's, you know, really, it's difficult to put yourself in their place and even begin to imagine what it must be like. I had the misfortune of being in the hospital for some time this summer, and I was almost finished with writing the book by that time, and I felt so desolate in a hospital room, not knowing at the time when I was going to get out, this week, next week, whenever. I had people watching over me, very kind to me. My wife was there. My children and grandchildren visited, and I felt absolutely alone, abandoned, and unable to figure when I get out. And I'm thinking of a person in solitary confinement who doesn't have agreeable people all around him, who is serving a sentence that is basically sometimes without limit. Even if it has a limit, it goes on. If it's what they call LWOP, life without the possibility of parole, or 10 or 20 to life. First of all, many of the people, if it's death row, they are in solitary confinement.
Right, right.
It is almost impossible to imagine what this is like. It varies by the state, but generally the cell that they're in is roughly sometimes 9 by 12. It's a fairly decent size. There are some that are smaller than that. There are some that are just the size of the mattress that they sleep on. They stay in those cells without windows for 23 hours a day. They are allowed 1 hour out. They have no interaction with any other human beings, let alone visitors. They can't have intercourse with any of the other prisoners. They're fed through a flap that the tray is pushed through that they eat on.
Only a pizza could fit, probably.
Basically,
right?
Forever. I mean, how do people do that?
And let me ask you this, Stanley, too, because I mean, on one hand, of course, there are criminals out there, and there are murderers, and there are despicable humans that need to be incarcerated.
Right.
But what do you think the percentage is of people who are innocent who get convicted of crimes?
Well, there are various accounts and estimates. The one that seemed to me, of course, this dealt mostly with capital conviction. You know, it's hard to figure somebody who got arrested and put away for stealing a loaf of bread or something, or shoplifting from a store.
Or a candy bar, I heard a couple of weeks ago.
although I have a there's a case in here that is unbelievable in that regard. But generally speaking, we're dealing with capital cases or long-term convictions, and the estimates are that 4.1% of the people on death row or in solitary are in fact innocent. Other estimates go as high as 10%. It's very difficult to assess it because it keeps changing. But and it's difficult to decide, you know, who qualifies and who doesn't. Some only count the error if the person is exonerated and freed. Others say if they're technically innocent, but possibly guilty, that you don't count those. Only what they call actual innocence counts. But generally, the estimate, you know, is four, as I say, from anywhere between 4.1% to 10%, which is an enormous percent if you stop and think of it. You know, there are millions of people that we have incarcerated. We lead the world in that. And as a matter of fact, the latest estimate I saw was 2.2 million. One of the difficulties in putting a book like this together is things are going on at the same time that you're researching and writing it.
Oh, that's true. It's changing so fast, isn't it?
It's changing all the time, and could make you half crazy, because I have something, I read it, and I have a certain figure of how many people are incarcerated, and then I read that a new survey changed it, and I got to go back and change that. And that happens not only on all the figures, but on individual cases. There are instances where I write up a case, and say that it's on appeal, and he's awaiting disposition of the sentence. And a few of them, after I submitted the manuscript, a few of them changed. And I had to go back and make the changes. And so it does keep on changing, but there seems to be no doubt that the United States has incarcerated more people than any other country on earth, which is kind of staggering when you figure the populations.
These people who are innocent but get convicted, what's wrong with the system to do that? I mean, what breaks down, Stanley?
Where do we begin? Now, I'll tell you something interesting. You know, the title, Convicting the Innocent, the subtitle mentions the broken system of justice. What I was thinking after I had done this, and I've been on some other shows talking about it, it dawned on me that the system isn't really broken. To say something broken implies that there was a time when it wasn't broken. When it was whole, it worked, it was fixed. And that wasn't the case. It always has been broken or ineffective in that sense. And there are a number of reasons, basic reasons, that lead to wrongful convictions. The most staggering one of all is official misconduct. Official misconduct implies judicial error, prosecutorial error, police error, and so forth.
Intentionally.
Not intentionally. Very often intentionally.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes they do make a mistake. But most of the cases, as a matter of fact, I've gone through altogether, I think there must be about 75 cases in here. And I would say that almost all have involved some type of official misconduct.
Just to get a conviction, Stanley?
Yes, that's the prosecutorial part. Is that you advance in the district attorney's office not by seeking justice but by getting convictions, and that's it's the same thing with police also. How many collars did you get?
So these prosecutors would rather convict someone that, I mean, do they think in their own minds that the person truly is guilty?
Sometimes, you know, you do all of these cases, and occasionally you wonder. Some of the cases that I did, as I say, about 70 or so in this book. I did 100 in a previous book called The Wrong Men, which was published about 12, 13 years ago. It's hard to figure. Sometimes it seems absolutely clear that this is being done. It's planned in advance, and it's done intentionally. And as a matter of fact, there's a case in this book, the case of Peter Lamone in Massachusetts, who did 30 years, more than 30 years, for a crime that he didn't commit, that he was set up for. Who set him up? The FBI. There's been a book and a movie out in the past, I would say, year or two, involving a gangster by the name of Whitey Bulger.
Oh, yeah. We've heard about him.
Yeah. Well, he was one of the people involved in this case in that he was paid. He was a paid informant by the FBI, as well as a number of others. And they were paid to inform on other people. In return for their information that sent other people, some guilty, some not, to prison, they were given immunity.
Stay with us for a second, Stanley. We're going to hit this break. We're going to come back with much more as we talk about convicting the innocent. Next hour, let's open up the phone lines. Maybe you want to share a story like this. We'll be back. Well, I'm here in St. Louis for about 2 weeks before I head back to Los Angeles, and lots going on in St. Louis. As a matter of fact, circle your calendar for Saturday, June 18th, for my live stage show event at Lindenwood University. One of the guests, UFO expert Stanton Friedman, and many surprises. So just go to 971talk.com for full details there. We want to jam that place up. 971talk.com. And also this Thursday, I'm going to be at the St. Louis Finals of the Golden Gloves. I've been invited to attend there, and I'm going to go. It's at the St. Charles Banquet Center. And it's this Thursday night. I've got to tell you, many of you have seen the Rocky movies, right? Well, you remember the gym that Rocky used to box in, where all these younger people were in there boxing away and training? They were in there because they weren't on the streets doing things, buying drugs and doing stupid things. They were in there training. And that's what's so important about the Golden Gloves, the St. Louis Finals especially, where younger people are truly doing something that they enjoy, and they're off the streets. World-renowned boxing announcer Peter Vaccaro is going to be there. It's well worth going just to hear Peter. But I'm going to be there this Thursday. Come on by. Let's all sit together and watch these young kids do what they do for the Golden Gloves, the St. Louis Finals. That'll be this Thursday at the St. Charles Banquet Center, and I'm so glad that I'm an invited guest there. We're going to come back in a moment with Stanley Cohen and talk more about convicting the innocent right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Stanley Cohen with us. Stanley, let's get back into this. So Whitey, of course, was an informant, but they took him away finally. What happened to him?
It took about 30 years till they found him. He was in exile. He left with his girlfriend. I've forgotten her name. And they were living somewhere in California. Somebody saw him, spotted him, tipped him off. But Bulger, he was the main hitman. But you had other people. You had the Fermi, the rifle. What was his name? Steve, the rifle Fermi, I think it was. And what was remarkable is that the FBI hired them, and they would kill people and cover up things, and the FBI was involved in the cover-up. And it went all the way to the top. The much revered at the time J. Edgar Hoover, who was considered a god by half the people in the country, he knew about this. He was part of it. And they were paying people and setting them up. So Peter Lamone is one of, I think, four people at the time who went up for a murder that they framed him. They knew he didn't do it, but they framed him because they didn't want the real murderer to get hit. So he went away, and he was gone for over 30 years.
Jeez.
I think two of the fellas died in prison, and one died shortly after he got out. So far as I know, I don't know whether Lamone still is alive, but I think he haven't read anything otherwise. And see, one of the problems with official misconduct, that's just one of five or six main causes of wrongful conviction. But what's critical about it, it's not random people doing something screwy. It's not one DA or two cops, you know, who want to get involved in this kind of thing. It's part of the culture. It's part of the criminal justice culture of many systems throughout the country. I mean, we know that in recent years, Chicago, Cleveland, and Los Angeles have been found to have an internal corruption of their own system of prosecutorial and police activity. The Justice Department of the United States has investigated them. They were named as being corrupt at its core. And so when I say it's part of the culture, you have a cop come into a precinct, and he's as straight as an arrow. But these things are going on, and you know, the what they call the blue shield of silence, I forgot what it is exactly. They have a code. You don't rat out these guys. And you know, they had that picture, the movie, his name begins with an S, who blew the whistle and was driven out of the department. You know, it's just part of the whole culture. This is what we do, this is the way it works. And particularly in prosecution, fundamentally, the idea of the trial is to have the truth emerge in cross currents of questioning. The defense questions people, the prosecutor, you know, it's a kind of Socratic method. And eventually the truth is supposed to emerge. But
Serpico was the guy's name.
Yes.
Frank Serpico, right?
Serpico was right. Yes, Serpico. That's what I was trying to think of.
Pacino played him in that movie.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Good movie, too, by the way.
Yeah, it really was. At this age, I forget those things. I only remember it if it's more than 50 years old.
Well, Stanley, let me ask you this, though. I mean, there's no question there's corruption. There's no question that mistakes are made. I'm a proponent of the death penalty, capital punishment, but I've changed my views a little bit in that I think before you put somebody to death and get them put away like that, you have to have DNA evidence or something other than a jury's decision based on that. I mean, you have to have more evidence if you're going to convict someone and kill somebody, I think.
Well, there's still going to be error.
I mean, there's still going to be error.
In my book, you are still the proponent of capital punishment. I know so many people who, you know, as a matter of fact, my brother-in-law who's here, we've argued this thing for 40 or 50 years, and he said, you know, I read your book and kind of convinced me. It doesn't work.
Well, see, I'm convinced in your book that you're not for capital punishment, not because you don't want to put away some of these murderers and people that deserve it. It's that the innocent are being killed, too.
Yes, but it's more than that. I mean, I've been opposed to this for, I hate to say it now, for 60 years. It started when I was in college. And I'm opposed to it, number one, on moral grounds. I'm opposed to it also on the fact that there is no evidence that anyone has that it's a deterrent of any type. As a matter of fact, every study that's been made of any consequence has determined that it has zero deterrent effect.
I agree with that. I agree
so
with
if
that.
If it doesn't deter and there's a chance of killing innocent people, the only reason to have it is to take revenge and say he killed someone else, he deserves to die. And I just don't think that that human beings have the right to decide who lives and who dies. So I think there's no grounds for having it. You know, states, there are a number of states that had it and did away with it. And when they ended it, the capital crimes dropped. There are twin states sometimes, the two Dakotas. The one, I forget which is which now, one has capital punishment, one does not. The demography is pretty similar for both of them. But the one with capital punishment has more murders. And there seems to be no reason for it if there's, you know, one chance in 1,000 that somebody innocent is going to be executed for no reason. I don't see any justification for having it at all.
That's an interesting take. When we open up the phone lines next hour, let's get some people's views on that one.
Yeah, well,
specifically.
Let me interrupt for a second. Is that they take regular polls, public polls, like they do for elections, and you know, who's in favor of capital punishment and not? The last one, if I remember, that was in 2013, and 56% of the population they said would still favored it. What was huge, though, what was really amazing, was that it was over 80% in the 1990s. I think 1990.
Yeah, it's dropped tremendously.
It's dropped enormously.
Yeah.
And it continues to, you know, because this, people are becoming more aware of the injustice of our justice system. And largely that's because of DNA. And there's become an increased awareness of it. The press covers it more. Even in politics, you know, I mean, politicians run on this now, and I would warrant this, that if a Democrat is elected this year, that that will be the end of capital punishment in the United States.
You might be right. You may very well be right. Do they go after the crooked prosecutor who does stuff like this? I've really never hear of the prosecution being arrested for doctoring evidence or anything like that.
It's very rare. You see, it's a hard thing to prove definitely that they did this or did that.
With malice too, especially.
With malice, yeah. I mean, they would have to show that the prosecutor decided that he was going to, in effect, frame this guy and have evidence planted or to get a cop on the stand to lie. Those things do happen, and they do get prosecuted now and then, but it's a very difficult thing to prove. And so, for the most part, they don't. And as I said, it's just part of the culture. You know, the system prefers not to convict dirty cops, attorneys, or anyone else. It really prefers not to. We've seen that again and again. There was that case of the fellow in New York who was strangled, I guess you'd have to say. Big, heavy fellow, but there were four cops there. He was selling loose cigarettes. And he didn't respond to the police, and one of them grabbed him, they choked him. Now, the grand jury did not choose to indict, but the prosecutor, who was supposed to, in effect, be giving the case for the defendant, sounded as he was giving the case for the prosecution. And so the grand jury refused to indict. I don't know how that could happen, but that's exactly what happened. There's no one to convict, but, you know, most people understood that the cop was, you have four armed cops and one big fat guy with cigarettes. It doesn't seem to make sense that the only way to control him is to kill him.
Or that other video picture that we've had of the cop. And we, by the way, we have huge cop audience listening to us, and I love them dearly. But you do have those bad apples in the basket.
That's right.
I remember that video months ago of the individual that was stopped by the police officer in his car. He got out of the car and started running. That was not too smart. But right. The police officer chased him and gunned him down.
Right.
Remember that one?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Well, what would you do, Stanley, to fix a situation where you still need courts, you still need trials, you still need to convict the true criminals? What would you do? How would you fix it?
It's very, people ask
that's me the $64,000 question.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, if I really knew how to do it, I would cash in on this thing and I'd be, you know, living on an island somewhere that surrounded by hula girls. I mean, one of the things that you can do is try to move the system in a way that the prosecution is not rewarded for convictions. They're rewarded instead for having a fair and just verdict. The other thing, it's, you know, very much of it, of course, stems from the politics of the situation and the public. You know, a politician is afraid ever to say we need to do away with capital punishment. But Bernie Sanders says that. He's one of the very few who are willing to flat out say it, because there's a sense that the public wants what they call law and order, to be tough on crime. And they think that makes them safer. It doesn't make them safer, because one of the leading states in homicides is Texas. And Texas executes about half all the people executed in the country. You know, I say somewhere in the book that in Texas, capital punishment is second only to football as a pastime. And it doesn't help. But it's very difficult politically. And it's also difficult because the United States, after all, is a federation, and different states react in different ways. You know, all the other countries that have abolished it, and the statistics on the countries that have abolished it really are incredible. When you talk about the death penalty, I want to make sure I get of the 195 nations affiliated with the United Nations, not only members but those who have seats but don't vote and so forth, but out of 195, only 37 still have the death penalty. There were no nations in the industrialized West that have it, It's banned all over Eastern, the EU, the European Union, all banned. South America, all banned. Canada, Mexico. I mean, how many people know or were aware that when there was all this talk about Obama going to Cuba and what a gangster state, totalitarian state Cuba is, do you know that in 2013, Cuba abolished capital punishment?
Yeah, no, that's right.
We still have it.
We still have it.
You know, when you think about it, we are fifth in the world in executing citizens. You know, the four nations that are higher than us are China, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Iran.
Yep.
That's the company we're in.
Yep.
So, I mean, there's something there, and, you know, it's very largely, I think, political and, you know, a matter of states. The only way to ban it completely is for the Supreme Court to decide that it's a violation of the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment.
Have we executed someone and then we found out the person was innocent?
Yeah. I'll tell you, this is very difficult. You know, I mean, the late Justice Scalia, I hate to speak badly of him, but he was you know, absolutely miserable when it came to this kind of stuff. He said at one point, I mean, some of the things he said about capital punishment are amazing.
Well, let the facts speak as they may. So what did he say?
Okay. Let me see if I could find it right here.
Okay.
Right here in the book and quote what he said. You know, when I was looking for some of this stuff on the Internet, I always insisted that I get at least two or three instances of that quote, you know, to make sure that I have it right. But Scalia.
And he's been a longtime proponent of the death penalty, was he not?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, here's one thing that he said when one of the executions went wrong, lethal injection went wrong, and the person was jumping in pain for half an hour before he died. He says, where does it come from that in the execution of a person who has been convicted of killing people, we must choose the least painful method possible? Is that somewhere in the Constitution? How enviable quiet death by lethal injection? You know, I'm to me, that sounds completely wacky, but what I'm looking to find is the one where he says innocent, there's no evidence that innocent people were executed, and he also says that
and you say that's not the case. There are cases.
That's not the case. But he was wrong in two ways. Let me just take a minute and see.
Well, you don't forget this is live radio, Stanley.
Yeah, I understand.
You can't just go away from me for 2 minutes.
Okay. What he
you can get it after the when we get to the break at the top of the hour.
Yeah, okay. But I mean, fundamentally what he said that there's no guarantee of that a person has to be guilty in order to be executed. All we guarantee in the Constitution is that he gets a fair trial. If he gets a fair trial, there's no judicial or prosecutorial error, and we find that he is actually innocent, that should not prevent us from executing him. To me, that's completely wacky. He also said that there's no evidence at all that anyone who has been executed was in fact innocent. And in that, he was wrong in two cases. One is that there have been cases, very few, but the reason there are very few is that all investigation, and he knows that or knew that all investigation ceases when the execution takes place. At that point, nobody is looking to see if he was really guilty or not. The state will spend no funds looking to see whether a dead man really was innocent. And very rarely will his survivors, who generally were not very wealthy anyway, going to hire people to investigate it. That's the only reason. But there have been cases. One of them was you know, flat out beyond any doubt, because it was the husband and wife who were both convicted of the murder. What happens, they were tried separately. They were both convicted and sentenced to death separately. In time, it was discovered that the woman was innocent, that somebody else had admitted to committing the crime, there were witnesses to say that the other person did it, and so she was freed.
What a disaster that could have been. Stay with us. Stanley, we'll come back in a moment on Coast to Coast, give you a few minutes to look for that Scalia info, and then we'll take phone calls, too, on Coast to Coast AM.